From the Land of Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 21st day of 2014. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker. He's at CGB Enterprises out of Mandeville, Louisiana. We'll hear our final installment from the folks that are on the road, at least, with the Pro Farmer Crop Tour. And we'll take a look at what's been happening in the weather forecast. That with Mike Tenora. He's at T-Storm Weather in Chicago, Illinois. And oh, we'll discuss the marketplace with Matt Bennett, too. All on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, let's check in Chicago now at the CME Group, where the numbers for the afternoon finished like this. The nearby contract and the soft red winter wheat at $5.46 and a quarter, up 6 3/4. That's the September. December at $5.55 and a half, 5 and a half higher. And July of next year at $5.89 and a quarter, up 2 cents. The corn futures in the nearby September, $3.62 and a quarter, up 2 3/4. December at $3.69, a penny and a half higher. And the March futures at $3.81 and 3/4, up 1 1/4. May corn, $3.89 and 3/4, up a penny. July at $3.96 and a half, a penny and a quarter higher. In December at $4.09 and 3/4, that's for next year, up 1 1/4 cents. September beans, 16 and a half cents higher for the day at $11.36 and a quarter. November at $10.38 and a quarter, up 1/4 cent. January down a half at $10.45 and a quarter. The March at $10.52 and a quarter, and the corn in the soybean pit down 1/4 cent. And the November beans at $10.45 and 3/4 for next year, 3/4 cent lower. Bean meal up $11.20 at $4.13.80. Bean oil at $32.78. That's 8 cents lower. Live cattle futures in the August at $149.65, up 40 cents for the afternoon. October at $145.55, up 15. August futures at $215.20, up 25 cents. The October at $208.60, down $1.77.5. And the October lean hogs on the day, $93.62.5, $1.12.5 higher. You, of course, are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. You can find us online at willag.org. That's WILLAG.org. We come to you from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Checking the outside markets at this hour, crude oil futures, $94.05 a barrel, up 60 cents. They are above gasoline. That's the wholesale price at $2.74.09. 3 6/10 higher. Ethanol futures at $2.15, up 2 6/10 cents, and the difference between the two is 59 4/10 cents wide. That's a penny and a tenth wider than it was yesterday. Natural gas at $3.87 6/10, 5 3/10 higher. Diesel fuel at $2.83 and a half for a gallon, 9 10 cents higher. And gold futures at $1,273.90. That's a settlement price, $19.80 lower. The U.S. dollar at 82.15. is down 0.07. Here's what the weather forecast looks like. It comes from the National Weather Service for the Urbana-Champaign area this afternoon. Partly sunny skies, a high of 88 degrees on a south-southwest wind at about 8 miles an hour tonight, a 30% chance of showers, some thunderstorms. Those will come after 10 in the evening, partly cloudy, a low of 72, and then tomorrow, 20% chance of showers, some thunderstorms, mostly sunny and 92. Friday, a 30% chance of rainfall, partly cloudy and 73. Saturday, sunny skies and 91. Saturday night, cloudy and 72. Sunday, mostly sunny skies and 92 degrees, and Sunday night, partly cloudy and a low of 71. Monday, mostly sunny to start the work week with a high of 91 degrees. We'll talk with Mike Tenora at the bottom of the half hour. He'll tell you just a bit about how the weather has an impact on the corn and the soybean crops as we go through the month of August and how it's related or potentially not to the crop condition numbers. That's all at the bottom of the half hour here on willag.org. It is a Thursday afternoon. Let's check now the agricultural futures markets on this 21st day of August with Dan Zwicker. He's at CGB Enterprises in Mandeville, Louisiana. Good afternoon to you, Dan.
Hi, Todd.
I hear that while we're hot, you're hot down there.
Well, the humidity has it that it actually feels like 100 outside, and when the sun's coming down on you, I mean, it feels like you're 110, but it does have the 100-degree feel today.
We're not quite at 100. The heat index outside the studios here is at 97, so I guess although 3 degrees can make a big difference. It really can. Well, congratulations for being in New Orleans. How about that?
Yeah. I would rather take the Waco, Texas 100. It's a much drier heat. It's more like being in the oven than the sauna, so...
I just do not have either one, frankly, I think. Okay, so tell me about this marketplace today, because actually the numbers are starting to turn to look, you know, pretty nice, given that we're on the bottom end of the range, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, corn futures are starting to, you know, kind of build maybe a sideways or rounded type bottom over the past 4 to 5 weeks. We really haven't... I mean, if you go back to, you know, July 27th, D's corn closed at 363, and today we close at 362. So we're not making much headway on the upside, but on the other hand, we're not making any downside, any headway on the downside. And I do think that the corn market, if it can't make new lows this week, or if they can't get it done by tomorrow, I'm not too sure they're going to have much success in making new lows because, I mean, if you look at the news this week, we started out the week with a Wall Street Journal article based in Decatur, Illinois, telling the world that the farmers are up to their ears in corn. And then we go on the Pro Farmer Tour, and we hear all of these lofty yield estimates coming out of the Pro Farmer Tour. And now we had a well-known market analyst on CNBC this morning, and the commentators were wanting him to talk about sharply lower prices because of all this big corn crop. So it has definitely all signs that that you would think that the market could be maybe that maybe we have a low in the crosshairs, at least for the time being, until more is known about the size of the crop and what farmers are going to do about it. The grain trade is short. They need cash inventory to come on down to the Gulf to meet export commitments. I'm sure they need cash grain to go into the ethanol pipelines, very good margins in ethanol. So, and harvest is basically running a couple weeks behind average because of so much moisture that we had this summer.
Now, I'm not going to ask you if we put a low in yet, but do you think we will put the low in prior to harvest is really my thought process here.
Well, the thing that's going to be the shocker, I think, and everybody has a different opinion on it, is the acreage adjustments, which usually show up in the October report.
There are ways away.
And so the September report, I doubt if we'll see any acreage adjustments. And then the question then is, how much of a bump up in yield does USGA do in corn? I saw Scott Irwin's tweet or something on Facebook that was saying that the heat here closing out the season with this heat kind of implies that maybe the yield may not go up that much more. We'll have to kind of see on that, but I mean the yield reports or yield checks definitely would imply that we got some room to go up. Beans, I'm not so sure about that. I've heard as many bad things about beans as I've heard about good things, so maybe the bean yield doesn't do much movement in the September report. And if you don't get big numbers in the September report and then USGA comes in and starts whacking the acres, what the FSA report would imply, all of a sudden the market has already priced in the biggest crop and the biggest ending stocks levels, and then that may push end users off the bench and start buying. So we'll have to see how things play out here over the next month or so, but You know, I think corn is in position here to push to the upside, and if it does, and if we close out the month of August higher, I think that would be a good sign that maybe all of the supply bearishness has maybe been put into the market, and the demand bulls are going to start coming in and start buying this market.
We'll keep watching it and check in again with you next week.
Very well, Todd.
Mm-hmm. Dan Zwicker is with CGB Enterprises. He's in Mandeville, Louisiana. Joins us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. Time to check in on this Thursday with Brian Grady. He is on the eastern leg of the Pro Farmer Midwest Crop Tour, finished up Illinois yesterday, which had a really pretty good number. Brian, what was the number for corn, and how did you see that crop?
Well, tour samples came out with an average yield of 196.96, so basically 197 bushel per acre. Illinois corn crop is phenomenal this year. Very steady across the board. You know, we had some big numbers, but we didn't have any monsters. We had, I think, our highest sample that we took out of 180 out of the state of Illinois was like 284 in that range. So nothing over 300. We'd heard that we'd be getting some of those samples, and I'm sure they're out there. They just didn't happen to fall in any of the random stops that we made or the random spots in the fields where we go into. So it's the best Illinois corn crop I've seen. It's very strong. It's healthy for the most part, and it's going to finish off strong, I think, because of the maturity. It's there. It's heading toward the finish line, and just needs a little bit more time is all, but it's a very good crop.
The tour routes run through the northern one half of the state, but not the southern half of the state. Historically, how much of an adjustment downward, percentage or otherwise, might there be between the pro farmer numbers and the crop tour numbers for the state of Illinois?
Well, we take that into account, but there isn't a specific factor that because any given year it changes. So I think that obviously, you know, we take the heart out of the state of Illinois typically. This year, by all accounts, it seems like the southern half is doing probably a little bit better than what it has in the past. And as a result, we'll take that into account when we come up with the pro farmer estimate on that we release on Friday afternoon.
Where are you at this 9 o'clock hour on Thursday morning in the state of Iowa? And what kinds of crops have you seen?
We're in northeast Iowa, so we headed out of Iowa City, and currently we're in Buchanan, southern Buchanan County. We've seen some variability. The last one we came out of was a poorer field that had some nitrogen deficiency. We were into one earlier that had some hail damage and stuff like that. So there's some mix out here. It's not as uniform as what we saw in Illinois by any means. Eastern Iowa yesterday, when we came across the border, it was dry, very dry in District 6 there, in Teter County, Scott County, that area. They just missed some rains and spent a month or so since they've had a good solid rain, and it showed, you know, the crops aren't doing nearly as well as what they are over in Illinois, at least from what I've seen.
Brian, thanks so much, and we look forward to talking with you again on Friday afternoon for our Commodity Week program.
All right, thank you.
Brian Grady, of course, is on the eastern leg of the Pro Farmer Midwest Crop Tour. On the western leg is Chip Flory. He joins us now. Chip, where are you today?
Right now we are in Humboldt County, Minnesota. And I just backed back into the truck because it's starting to rain up here.
Mm-hmm. Pouring down rain. And I think you're going to get a lot more rainfall over the next, I don't know, week or so up there. How's the crop faring?
You know, you can see a lot of the problems that Minnesota had early in the year. This is an area of the world that back in June, over a four-day period, they got anywhere from 12 to 16 inches of rain. The corn crop just doesn't have the good green lush color to it like we saw yesterday in western Iowa. There's some obvious nitrogen problems up here, and it's showing up, I think, too, in the grain length. The maturity of the crop might be just a touch behind what I would like to see up here, but it really feels like a very ordinary corn crop that we've looked at so far up here in Minnesota.
Tell me about the numbers from Iowa yesterday. You put those together tonight with the eastern leg numbers and have a final number for the state. But how did it turn out in the western side?
You know, it was really impressive. And like I said, we saw good color on that corn crop. saw good color on the bean crop all the way up until about Highway 3, which is in the northern part of the state. And once we got up into that area, again, that was far enough north that it caught some of those really heavy June rains. Some of the guys at our meeting last night in Spencer, Iowa, talked about they had up to 24 inches of rain in 4 days. And so there's ponding up in northern northwest Iowa, ground out spots out in the field. And even the areas where in cornfields where they went back in and planted soybeans trying to get something off of those drowned out areas. But, Todd, we saw a good corn crop in western Iowa. There's no question about it. All three of the districts in the western part of the state were up from a year ago. The biggest increase over a year ago was in the southwest district. The West Central District was up about 5% from a year ago, and then the Northwest District was up about 1% from last year. And a lot of the reason for the increase, it's not only the ear population out there, we're also finding some longer ears in western Iowa, so things really look pretty good.
And the soybean crop in that part of the world?
Solid. I wouldn't call it outstanding, but it's a very good bean crop over there. The maturity of the pod, maybe, they are behind what I would like to see. Just don't have a lot of fill on them yet, but hey, we got that rain overnight. We had rain in western Iowa yesterday, and that rain is in the fourth week of August, you know what that does to a bean crop. It helps fill up those pods, make a big bean, and gives us every opportunity that we need to make a good bean crop.
Hey, Chip, thanks to you and Brian for taking the time with us each day on the tour this week. We really do appreciate that. Have a safe rest of the tour this afternoon, and good luck getting back home and putting the numbers together for tomorrow.
You bet. Thanks, Todd.
Chip Flory from the western leg of the Pro Farmer Midwest Crop Tour. Now up next, as summer draws to a close, Backyard Industries' Lisa Braltz happens upon writer Ava Chin's memoir, Eating Wildly, and discovers that being in the weeds isn't always a bad thing.
It's unmistakable. The end of summer is approaching. Summer vacations are wrapping up. Kids are getting ready to go back to school if they're not already there. And in my case, piles of books remain unread. Recently, I flipped through a stack I'd collected back in June, the promise of endless summer reading stretched out in front of me. I was now reduced to looking for one book, just one, that I could say I'd read over the summer. Nothing seemed right until I came across Ava Chin's food-driven memoir, Eating Wildly, Foraging for Life, Love, and the Perfect Meal. I couldn't resist. I'd been foraging for a book, after all. Food memoir is an increasingly popular subgenre. Novelists publish autobiographies with food as the backbone, such as, most memorably for me, 2013's Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites by Kate Christensen. Writers and bloggers whose beat is primarily food have come up with wonderfully evocative memoirs based on their experiences. Two of many examples include food critic and former gourmet magazine editor Ruth Reichel's food memoir trilogy, written in the late 90s through the middle of the last decade, and blogger Molly Weisenberg's more recent food memoir duo, written over the last 5 years. Even straight-up cookbooks sometimes have a more autobiographical feel to them lately. Kevin West's Saving the Season, inspired by his grandmother's penchant for preserving the harvest, is a recent example of a cookbook's recipes being given context and depth through memoir-style storytelling. Reading their stories somehow makes the recipes in their books seem more attainable and less intimidating. Ava Chin's book fits this bill, but with a twist. Instead of spending all her time in the restaurants and grocery stores of her hometown, New York City, or cooking in her small Brooklyn kitchen, she spends much of it in the parks and wilder areas of the city, foraging for greens, herbs, mushrooms, and even bees, occasionally writing a column for the New York Times called The Urban Forager. But Eating Wildly isn't a field guide, at least not in the traditional sense. There are no illustrations or photos, for example. Instead, Chin deftly interweaves stories about her relationships with her family, an absent father, a larger-than-life grandmother, a grandfather who encouraged her love for wild foods, and a somewhat distant and often confounding mother, with her trips within the city and elsewhere, such as Colorado. She's always hunting for something to eat, but also for a deeper connection, not just to the natural world, but also to her world of family, friends, and potential life partners. She readily shares what she finds with the people closest to her, and not always with the intended or hoped-for results. The book is divided by seasons. Even winter gets a few pages. And each section ends with instructions for preserving foraged food and recipes for cooking it. Her short descriptions of the extremely thorny work of harvesting blackberries, the fortuitous discovery of a mulberry tree after the death of a relative, and a successful morel mushroom hunt with a friend at an undisclosed location, one that only bore fruit once she literally got down to mushroom level, are just terrific. Her tale of seeing bees swarm for the first time on a busy campus while most passerby didn't even notice what was happening right next to them reminded me of similar stories in another book, The Urban Bestiary by Lyanda Linhout. Chin even has a bit of a run-in with the law and is eventually forced, as foraging becomes a hotter topic in food circles and even the mainstream media, to examine her reasons for doing it. And as she told a radio producer, "Foraging reminds me that the world is a generous place. Even when things are topsy-turvy, I know that the plants will always sprout in the spring, become lush in the summer, and then grow dormant in the winter. And the following year, it'll happen all over again." For Backyard Industry, this is Lisa Braltz.
Support comes from Common Ground Food Co-op in downtown Urbana, with a deli featuring iced lattes made with fairly traded ingredients and local milk, and a salad bar filled with local and organic ingredients. More information is at commonground.coop. And from the Black Dog Smoke and Ale House, serving barbecue beef brisket, pork shoulder, ribs, chicken, and more, slow-cooked over a wood-fired smoker. Open Sunday through Thursday, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m., and Friday and Saturday, 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. The Black Dog, 201 North Broadway in downtown Urbana.
Matt Bennett on this Thursday afternoon on the phone line now to take up the marketplace with us, too. He's recently returned from the Pro Farmer Midwest Crop Tour. Matt, how was your week out in, I don't know, you were in Nebraska and South Dakota and a little bit of Iowa, too, I think.
Yeah, it was a good week. I mean, we definitely saw a lot of different things that would maybe open my eyes just a little bit. I definitely felt as though I would see better crops than what I saw on the tour. And so, you know, I think that the eastern and western leg are two completely different things this year. And you know, I know some of the guys that I've talked to from the eastern leg have said they saw some of the best corn fields they've ever seen, and especially, you know, for instance, dry land on some of them that have done irrigated before. So, I mean, there's definitely two different, it's a mixed bag.
As a farmer, what'd you find of most interest?
I thought the most interesting thing for me was just seeing how ear counts made such a huge difference. You know, even in irrigated, we saw a lot of, you know, variability in ear counts, and then I think that they were able to put a huge ear on, and obviously they had plenty of moisture with the irrigation, but you know, whenever they lose in the spring because of whether it's weather or planting problems, whenever they lose that much population, it sure does hurt them on that yield.
Yeah, well, I had a question about this. Is this about population or number of ears on the number of stalks?
Well, we have had some scouts that have found significant areas where there was 2 ears per stalk. I didn't find that a whole lot. In fact, we found several where there was a second one trying to come, and, you know, they called them suckers, as in maybe they're, you know, actually sucking a little bit of life out of the plant and not going to make much of an ear. And so in all cases, it's not the greatest situation, especially where the ground's dry.
Matt, let's continue our conversation. I know you've been not only out on the tour, but watching what's happened in the marketplace. What do you think of the pop in the market today?
Well, it was nice to see a little bit of a pop in the market. I know I was able to talk markets today up in Decatur for Stu Ellis. He had a meeting up there, and one of the first times in the last couple months I've got to talk markets on a day when they're up. So it's a little easier talking. Guys are in a little bit better mood. But bottom line, I think that, you know, there's definitely still a fair amount of demand out there, and there's a lot of uncertainty as to what the total crop size is going to be when factoring in maybe some prevent plan acres along with, you know, there's a few problem areas out there.
Did they call you Mr. Gloom and Doom when you came out of this meeting?
No, you know, I think that, you know, nobody called me Dr. Doom or anything like that, but, you know, I think guys thought it was a realistic approach looking at things, and, you know, even if we might get a little bit of a bump in the markets, I think guys that are needing money in the fall would probably be well advised to maybe, if nothing else, lock basis in, because, you know, especially in our neck of the woods, I don't think it's any secret that storage might be at a premium once we get halfway or farther into harvest. So, you know, if everything's full, it's going to be tough to expect basis to be really anything strong at all.
And a very short word on soybeans.
Well, I think with beans, it's definitely been a situation where the weather's been conducive to really doing well for beans here in the end of the growing season. I think we're going to have a pretty darn good bean crop.
All right. Hey, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Matt Bennett is joins us from Windsor, Illinois, where he's based. And you can hear him each and every Thursday afternoon right here on the Closing Market Report. If you'd like to hear him again, you can always do that on our website. The address there is willag.org. Just as a reminder, tomorrow, Commodity Week comes up at 2:36 on our radio station. Our guest will bring Brian Grady from Pro Farmer to go through the final Pro Farmer numbers, not the tour numbers, but Pro Farmer. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Mike Tenora is with us. He's at T-Storm Weather in Chicago, Illinois. Mike, the folks from the Pro Farmer Midwest Crop Tour have made their way across the Midwest through Indiana, Illinois, Minnesota, Nebraska, and Iowa. And one of the things I think they have seen, despite the fact that we are at really high ratings for this time of the year for the crop for corn and soybeans, is that there's a lot of variation in that crop. Can you explain that through rainfall and weather and temperature and all the kinds of things that go into making a crop?
Sure. Well, there's several different factors that you need to look at. If you just look at the proportion of corn and soybeans that are rated good and excellent, corn would rank number 7 highest of the last 29 years, while soybeans would be tied for the 2nd highest ranking since 1986. So if you just had that information alone, you might be able to say to yourself, well, what would the yield be based on these types of ratings? And the interesting thing is that even though they do give you some clue as to where the yield might be, the relationship between the crop condition rating and the final yield is not as high as you might think. Now, for corn, it's certainly higher than soybeans. 68% of the variation in corn yield was explained by the crop condition rating for the current week. That was over 1986 to 2013. And that's after we detrend the yield to make sure that we look at yields so that they're all with 2014 technology, because technology does improve every year. So corn yields and soybean yields naturally rise. But for soybeans, it's interesting in that only 50% of the variation in soybean yield is explained by crop condition ratings for the current week. That means that 50% of the soybean variation is explained by other factors. So what are those other factors? Well, the big ones are rainfall and temperature, of course, and the timing of rainfall and temperatures are important. We do have a fairly wet pattern that's beginning in the central and northern areas of the soybean belt, and that is expected to continue through Monday, Tuesday, maybe even Wednesday. Rain at this time of the year when soybeans are filling is really the number one key to soybean yields. So this is a good situation for soybeans if rains continue to fall as expected over the next week. In the southern areas where it will be fairly hot and dry over the next week, and that does include southern Illinois, it's not the best situation to have temperatures turn hot, and the dry situation is not that great either. But remember, it was wet leading into the last few days. So the condition of the crop would be a bit more concerning if we hadn't received rainfall over the last 5 days and even the last 2 weeks.
Let's turn your attention now, Mike, out of the Midwest and into some of the other areas of the nation. When you look forward, it appears there might be a lot of rainfall that's coming into the Northwest. Can you tell me about that and what it might mean for some of those growing areas for spring wheat?
Yeah, you're exactly right. One of the reasons that we're going to turn much hotter across the Midwest over the next several days is because we have a series of storm systems that are moving from the Pacific Northwest through the Northern Plains. That includes most of the spring wheat belt of the U.S. and into the eastern half of the spring wheat belt in Canada. The interesting thing is that we're seeing some very large rainfall numbers coming out of numerous computer models. And when that happens, it usually means they're onto something. We could be seeing rainfall of 1 to 3 inches across Montana and much of the Dakotas and into Manitoba. That is a lot of rain for that area because they only average around 1/10 to 2/10 of an inch per 5 days at this time of the year. We're talking about nearly 2 months of rain over the next 5 days in an area that's going to be harvesting or is attempting to harvest now, and that is going to be a concern that we have to follow.
Okay, is there anything else you want to make sure that we cover before I let you go?
No, just that we really need to keep an eye on the temperatures over the next 5 to 7 days. It will be the warmest period of the corn and soybean growing season. We should see highs well into the 90s across at least the southern third to half of the corn and soybean belt. And we would really like to see that pattern break next week. Else we'll have to think a little bit more about temperatures this growing season.
Thanks so much for taking the time with us. We do appreciate it, Mike.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Mike Tenora, of course, is with T-Storm Weather. He's in Chicago, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report each and every Thursday afternoon. You can always find him again online at our website at willag.org. I'm Yovi Extension's Todd Gleason.